is required in this moment? A stern timeout? A shoulder shrug? A game of hide and seek and giggle? It depends. This child in front of me, this life that I am engaged with and whom I am now parent to, it may be that the behaviors are grounded in fear and confusion and need understanding. Sometimes they're grounded in defiance and self-destructive defiance and need to be challenged. And the problem is we don't always know, there's no mechanical way of knowing what to say, when to say, and so on. God, we trust God in that. In the New Testament, the apostles had a similar responsibility, but one on a much larger scale and with much more at stake. A young church needs unchanging truth and reminders of grace, hope in suffering, steadiness amidst confusion, unmasking of hypocrisy, the example of leaders who know God's strength and their own weakness. The Corinthian church is a primary example of a young church with an apostolic father, the Apostle Paul, father to that church, and he, stepping into the issues that concerned him, had to learn what to say, and when was a certain statement appropriate, and we find that, of course, in throughout this letter, there's a great deal of them asking him questions, responding, issuing challenges to him, pushing back. He exhorts and encourages and teaches. There's a lot in this correspondence. I mentioned last week, at the end of last week's sermon, that we would be re-entering 1 Corinthians in chapter 6 today. Chapter 6 is where we find this verse: "You are not your own. You are bought with a price," and the line that is written in the air out there that you can't see is the end of 6:20. It says, "Therefore, glorify or honor God with your body." We got up to this point in 1 Corinthians in January and February. We studied those texts, and now we're going to pick it up at this point, and we'll see this verse in our study this morning. And going forward from here, for the next few weeks, we're going to go from chapter 6 to the end of 1 Corinthians quickly. And the way we're going to do that is to stop at the points in this book where the Greek word soma is used by Paul. It is a word that is translated body. And the apostle uses this at critical points to teach them important things. I think it will help us catch a sweep of the whole book. But each time we encounter this word, it means something slightly different. So Paul will use the same word in different contexts to mean different things, all of them helpful, all of them challenging, I think, to us. Today in chapter 6 and next week in chapter 7, the word soma, translated body, has to do with our physical body, particularly in questions of sexuality and marriage. In chapters 10, 11, and 12, the word soma has to do with Christ's body, and in two different ways. This is my body, the bread of the communion table, which is for you. And in chapter 12, he speaks of the communion of the believing people as the body of Christ. And so there it's used, of Christ's body, meaning a community. Finally, in chapter 15, Paul speaks of resurrection bodies, both the Lord's and our own. We will participate, as he has already done, in a world of resurrection to come. So it's the same word. In context, it has different meanings. It's a way, I think, to find our way all the way through the book of 1 Corinthians. And by seeing these different meanings, I think we'll find ourselves learning to maybe connect some dots and see some insights that we might not otherwise. So let me read today, beginning in chapter 6, verse 12. I want to read a paragraph. Just listen. It won't appear on the screen right away, but just listen as I read. "Everything is permissible to me, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food for the stomach for food, but God will destroy them both. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also." Now, one of the problems in throughout 1 Corinthians, as I already mentioned, is that they have written stuff to him. He is responding to what he's read in these letters that have been written to him, which we don't have copies of. And at various points, he is quoting them and answering the quotation. And that's clearly the case here. The question is, we don't always know when is Paul speaking in his own voice, or when is he putting their words in print and then answering them. And you have to make some decisions, interpretive decisions. And so I want to kind of read these verses again. And in italics will appear what I think are the quotations from their letter and the answer that Paul gives. And by the time we get to verses 13 and 14, we're actually going to change the word order some in order to make the most sense of it, I think. But let's start out with verse 12. Everything is permissible for me. That's their line. But not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. So here we can sort of hear our strong-willed preschooler. I can do it myself. I'm in charge of my life. Who do you, and stomping his or her little foot. And so they're saying, well, I can do anything I want. Everything's permissible to me. Now, what's interesting, among the things that are interesting, is the fact that Paul does not tell them that they're mistaken in making this statement. In fact, it's possible that Paul himself, at some point earlier in his time in Corinth, used the line, all things are permissible, everything is permissible to me. That is consistent with, if you understand it correctly and put it in the right context and have a right in application of that thought, it is something that Paul has said other places and would understand. You remember, Paul himself was raised as an Orthodox Jew in a world that was filled with what is not permissible. Thousands upon thousands of life restrictions that had been built up over time by the most serious of Jews, what they could not do on the Sabbath, with whom they could not speak, what they could or couldn't eat, and so on and so on and so forth. Just hundreds and more of these restrictions, and that's the way you took on the world. And Paul does not, in answering the mistaken lives of the Corinthians, does not go back and say, well, I'm going to give you a list of what you can and can't do. If you think everything's permissible, I'm disagreeing with you, and here's the list. He asks a penetrating question. And I think it's important to realize as Christians that the law, strict application of the law, is never the answer to our fleshly behavior. We don't begin each day with wary of food that is unclean, places that are out of bounds, people that are unwelcome, or ideas that are forbidden. We don't have an instinctive wariness about everything that with which we take on life. But the penetrating questions remain. Things are permissible, but what benefits? What is wise? What is life-giving? What will help you become what you want to become? What will gain you that which is worth having? You have choices to make. Make ones that are healthy and wise and consistent with the heart of God, who wants only the best for you and wants to make you what you really want to be. How will you make those decisions? If we're not careful, we will hear the phrase, everything is permissible to me, and think, well, what would I like? What will give me the most pleasure? What's the easiest way out? But those questions are not going to get us what we want, give us what we hope for. The better question is, what's good? What's beneficial? So, are fantasy sports leagues permitted? Yeah. You have to figure out how edgy, how much time, how much money, what else you're sacrificing to be part of it. That's also the question. Is it permitted? There's no restriction, but is it wise? Is it healthy? Is one's approach to it the one that ends up getting you where you want to be? Are celebrity gossip websites permitted? Yeah? Why? What's the point? What do we gain? Is it wise to invite such things? Is working all the time, relentlessly, without a break. Permitted? Sure. But where does it get you? Why does the Bible instruct us about Sabbath? Do all of the people who are ever to be most admired in life figured out that there is more to life than work, and work relentlessly and only work? There's no rules, but there are important questions to ask about what's beneficial. Is safety the highest calling in the world, or is there sometimes when taking a risk is the best thing I can do? A risk that sort of breaks the old categories and allows me to see God. Again, without applying some rigid external set of this and that, yes or no, must or do not, he's asking these Corinthians to say, what will get you where you want to be? What is beneficial? The second statement is it makes the point, I think, perhaps more finely. Everything, I can do everything, so I'm choosing the beneficial thing. But sometimes we wake up and realize that there's some things I can't stop doing. Then what? That in all my choosing and all my foraging ahead in life, I have come to the point where there is a mastery, some addiction, some behavior that I now cannot stop. That my freedom has led to bondage. And the thing itself may or may not be evil, but by now it has taken control of me, and that is the problem. I will not be mastered by anything, says Paul. In my freedom, I won't allow myself to become a slave. Dieting and exercise are a good thing. Anorexia is not. Taken so far that these choices become destructive and thinking is so altered that you can't save yourself from the destructive mastery of what could have been a good thing in some other setting. Social media is a good thing. Living a virtual life with nothing else but virtuality is not. Being enslaved by something that has its positives but now has taken ownership. Planning ahead is a good thing. But a highly detailed, fear-driven 10-year plan for your life is not. You know, anticipating what's going to come, but allowing yourself to be mastered by all of that thinking so you can't stop slavishly obeying something that is not in itself wrong. That's the argument Paul's making here. And what he's leading us to is the presence of Christ. How do we stop these? I mean, He's helping diagnose the problem. Eventually, the answer, the help that's going to be given, the ultimate help, is to realize how much the Lord is for us and what he has done in purchasing and claiming and empowering us. But we need at least to know what the problem is. And instead of being the strong-willed preschooler who thinks that he or she knows everything. Turning to the next verses 13 and 14, here's where the word order is changed, but I think this represents what Paul is actually arguing. So once again, in italics is the language of the Corinthians, the food for the stomach and the stomach for food. And Paul's answer to that is, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. The dismissive notion that bodies are not for anything is answered in the statement, the Lord is for our bodies and our bodies for him. But God will destroy them both, they say. Doesn't, you know, not only this, they're, you know, physical processes that you burn up calories, they go away, it's all done. And someday, even the whole body, that the stomach and everything else is true of us, will burn up, go away, be destroyed. Paul answers that objection of theirs by saying, by his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. So what is the heart of the argument here? Food is for the stomach. The stomach's for food. Eating is, you know, of no consequence. I can do whatever I want. So the thinking behind what they're saying is this. Religion consists of high thoughts, moments of ecstasy, meditation, prayer, Bible study, worship. It consists of all these things. in which God is at the center of your thinking. But when the time is gone for such things, when you've moved on and the other elements of your life are taking place, the things you do don't matter at all. God's only interested in the religious wavelength of your experience, and the rest of your life doesn't matter. And so if we took it a step back, you could say, well, the clothes I wear don't matter. They're all going to wear out, burn up someday. The haircut I get doesn't matter. Hair grows out. I can get any haircut I want. It's not of great consequence. And then on to food. Well, food, it's fuel. You ingest it. It burns up. It's done. Goes away. And actually, Paul is going to push back against, he doesn't hear, but he is going to push back against the notion that there's nothing about our food decisions that are important. Because actually, most of the time, we eat in the company of other people, and there are real implications about that. But by taking the argument, the little thing to the greater thing to the greater thing, they're going to say, so what, sexual organs are for sex, and so I'll go to prostitutes, and it's not that big a deal. And Paul is, interrupting the train of thought here. He said, it is not true. The way you're thinking is wrong. What you're inferring is not true. Our bodies are not and never were intended for sexual immorality. You cannot pursue the point of view that you're advocating here. Turns out that there aren't religious and non-religious spheres of our lives. There aren't the times when God is important and the times when he is not important. And actually, the entire thrust of what the apostle is trying to say here is that instead of looking for the areas where we exclude God and disregard him and pay no attention, we ought to look for ways of enveloping everything so that all the choices we make of all kinds, whether they're specifically religious or very ordinary, all of them matter in the cause of my discipleship, my service of the Lord. And simple things like how I drive my car, how I pay my bills, the tone of voice I use with the people I meet, what I consume or don't consume, how I treat the planet we live on, how I regard animals, everything that God has made and that I participate in, that in every place I can go, every thought I can have, every action I can take, all of them become important rather than finding the small sphere where God lives and disregarding everything else. The fact that Paul is arguing for resurrection here, that's something that's going to become very important by the time we get to chapter 15. But if we are to be raised, and if there is a new existence, and there is, in which this life, in seed form, burst forth into some glorious thing we can't even imagine yet, then how the seed gets formed is crucial. I was thinking of the analogy of a symphony, which I know nothing about, so I'll probably get this wrong. But it may be the case that what we're doing in the 40, 60, 80, 90 years, however long we get to live this life in following the Lord, what we're doing is we're writing a very simple melody. Maybe just a few verses, a few notes, maybe a couple of chords. It's not complex, it's not remarkable, it's simple, but it is our own tune. And how we treat people, what we do, where we go, the entire range of our lives, our thoughts, our actions, all of them, is writing a unique tune. And the day will come in the resurrection when it becomes a symphony of such extraordinary beauty that our breath will be taken away. And everyone, each of us, are our own breathtaking symphony. But at the heart of the symphony, what gives it its unique thing is the little tune we're writing right now. The few little notes that we are creating by how we live our lives now are going to be made something amazing, but they are going to be unique to us, and we are participating now in what will happen then, and therefore we should take it seriously. Therefore we should make wise choices. Therefore we should include everything, not look for stuff to leave out. Verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Let me just observe a couple things before I finish. Go back and read this again. This is another place at which we can sort of see the parenting role that Paul's adopted here. Because there are times when we don't know things, when the role of the father is to instruct. And I think it was clear that in Corinth there were some people that didn't know basic things about either union with Christ or their sexuality. They had distorted notions of things. There is some teaching that has to go on. Do you not know? And I'll tell you what you might not otherwise know. There are also some that will hear that line as a challenge, where Paul's effectively saying, you know better, don't you? Because there were some who knew what he is now going to say and they wanted nothing to do with it. But both are both ways of thinking have some usefulness. Are there some who don't know? Yes. Are there some who deny what they know? Yes. And so the apostle wades in with these two times he will say in this paragraph, do you not know something? And then he will instruct, and finally he will issue a command, flee from sexual immorality. So back to verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Impossible. Do you not know that the man that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said the two will become one flesh. But he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body, but the one who sins sexually sins against his own body. So there are two big ideas. Do you know what's true of you, that Jesus Christ is present in your life all the time? Do you know what the implications of that are? And do you know what human sexuality has as its core to its existence? Do you know? I'm going to tell you some things. And again, I think we live in a world, especially regarding sexuality, that a great many of our contemporaries don't know any of this, don't know any of the insights that Paul has here. This will be extraordinary news to them, and we may well have a case for instruction and then a case for application. So the first one of these do you not knows has to do with the presence of Jesus in our life. That we are members of Christ. That wherever we go, wherever we are, whatever we say, whatever human connections we make, whatever we think, whatever happens when we're alone, Jesus goes with us. He is present. That to be a Christian means that he is present everywhere. And shall I take him to a brothel? Shall I have sex with a prostitute and invite Jesus into the experience? That's what you're doing, Paul says. Now this would have been eye-opening for a lot of these young Corinthian Christians. In Corinth, prostitution was a major part of the social life. Prostitutes came from the temple of the idol in Corinth. They were commonplace. Visiting a prostitute, kind of like going to Starbucks. I mean, it wasn't for them. It was not that big a deal. It was just part of who they were and what they did. It was commonplace. And yet Paul resists what was commonplace to them. He sees it with completely different eyes. And he says, you are taking Jesus into something where he does not belong. Are you going to make that choice and dishonor him in doing so? He's not going to stay back at your house. He doesn't live in the church. He lives in you. And wherever we go, he goes. He is united in whatever we unite ourselves to, we unite our Lord to. Let me make a couple of observations. I used to have a lot of Jesus t-shirts. I don't have any Jesus t-shirts anymore, partly because sort of my wardrobe has changed. I don't wear t-shirts that often. So that's my excuse for why I don't have and or wear Jesus t-shirts anymore. But here's an observation I made at one point. When I wore a Jesus t-shirt around, I always treated people better. I tipped more generously. I was less likely to swear. There were all kind of things that when I wore my Jesus t-shirt, changed the way I acted. And the idea that I'm not wearing clothing that has Jesus on it anymore does not change what was true then and is true always. And that is that he is where I am. And I, you know, I may be less aware of it, but it is no less true that everything I do, he partakes of. I have a friend, another thought along this line, and this is just particular to him. I mean, there may be others like him. I'm not saying this is always the case, but every time he gets more fervent about his faith, I get worried. Because it mostly goes like this. I realize of this particular friend that he is showing up on time for everything. He's volunteering for more, you know, service projects. He's praying more fervently. He's singing louder. He's every time you turn around, he's all in for the Lord and volunteering for mission trips, whatever it is. And the unfortunate process in this case is that almost always means that whatever the dark side of him is also in the ascendancy. Whatever the disobedient side of his life, whatever the choices he's making that are against the Lord and dishonor the Lord, are also growing greater. And instead of facing the thing, instead of inviting the Lord to help him with what's weak, he's trying to make up for it by being sort of extra fervent in his religious side. But it's exactly that bifurcation that the gospel knows nothing of. We are all one thing. We are always all one thing. And we can't just say, this will never last, it doesn't matter, it's insignificant. That Jesus wants to claim, and especially if we allow ourselves to say things of great significance are insignificant. We're fools. I think Paul says that sexual sin has a unique property to it. We sin against our own bodies. That's very difficult to interpret, but just very briefly, I think what he is saying is this, that our sexuality goes back as far as can be to our creation. That in making us, God breathed the spirit into the body, the human body he had made. He separated the man from the woman. Once united, they were separated. There is something that goes absolutely back to the very beginning. It is as ancient as it can be. Questions of how we use our bodies and their sexual possibilities. Every other sin comes later in history, if you will. Now, meaning that there has to be a social context. If I'm going to tell a lie, there's got to be somebody else I'm lying to. If I'm going to steal, then somebody else has property I'm stealing. If I'm going to dishonor my parents, I have to have parents. But all of those things come later in the human story, but at the very beginning of the human story is the possibility of real union with another person that should not be trifled with. And again, this isn't to say that sexual sins are worse, that God hates them more, that they, you know, have sort of ruinous consequences and nothing else has that. That's not the point he's making. But I do think he is saying you're dealing with the core stuff when you're making these choices. The imperative here is flee, then, from sexual immorality. Run from it. Whatever our weakness is, we should probably run from. All of us are going to have something that trips us up, it used to be true of us, and we're not strong enough to go back to it. You know, whatever, you know, the problem we had is. But certainly this is one. If it is a weakness, we should run. Not pretend that we can play with fire and get away with it. Verse 19. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God, that you are not your own, you were bought with a price, therefore honor God with your body. It's not enough, ever, for those who will speak biblical truth rightly, those who will preach the gospel, to just say what you should not do, to just announce the terrible nature of the problem, to just identify the thing that we should flee from, to just throw up your hands and recoil from the thought that sin with a prostitute takes Jesus into it, and recoil is enough. There always must be an alternative. And Paul's alternative is to say to this young church, do you understand who you are? Whatever you were, do you understand who you are now? You are the very home of God. Father, Son, and Spirit. The Father has given us the Spirit as a gift. We have received Him and are now His residents. The Son has paid an enormous price to redeem us. We are not who we used to be. We are not. We need not live with just kind of stumbling and getting up and stumbling and getting up with nothing to look forward to. We are claimed by another and have the possibility to live to honor Him. Why would we not do so? Why would we not choose the extraordinary gift that our lives can bring honor to God? That we could engage in service. That we could join with other people who love Him and sing His praise. That we could learn and give away truth that world is longing to know. That we could get involved in the redemptive work of God. That we could rest and glorify Him in our restfulness and all these possibilities. Whatever we were at one point, we are no longer. In every city in the ancient world, the most important building, the most beautiful building, the most central building in every city was the temple. Whoever their God was in the midst of the city. It was the most important thing. And in Christ, we are the temple. We are the most important thing. We are the most beautiful thing. We are the place where He resides, and we may, it is a privilege, we may honor Him with our bodies, our choices, our lives. Don't miss out. Don't settle for less. Don't let the past lay claim to what is not true now. You're not your own. Bought at a great price. The privilege that all of us now have is that our lives may honor the Lord. We're going to come to the communion table now. And this is the meditation this time for us, let me suggest, is to ask the Lord, how may my life be of honor to Him? What choice could I make today or tomorrow or this week that would glorify God? Where's an opportunity to live as the temple of the Lord in a way that is life-giving, life for my own enjoyment and for blessing for others? So that's what I'm going to ask you to kind of think through. In what way could we live out this possibility?